Okay, let's go on to Dr. Weinstein's case.
Okay, this is a 62-year-old woman who was said to have an abnormal mammogram about 6 months prior to my first seeing her, but with no description of any palpable abnormalities. So when I get to see her, she had had diffuse bone pain, mostly in her lumbar spine and in her hip. She has a palpable breast mass that measured 8 by 7 centimeters, and which comes to biopsy showing a combined invasive ductal and lobular cancer, which was ER positive, PR positive, and HER2 negative. She had a full set of imaging studies, which was totally unremarkable except for the previously described bone metastases.
Can you talk a little bit more about her? You said she had pain. How much pain was she having?
Pretty substantial pain, which her prior physicians ascribed to arthritic disease.
And where was it?
Lumbar spine and hip.
And what was her sort of lifestyle situation?
She was actually an administrative assistant at a brokerage house, a pretty intelligent woman, but the more I got to know her, I think that she was a bit of a denier and rather simplistic in her thinking.
Any other issues that you were considering as you thought through her therapy?
She had no prior medical problems, so she was in decent shape before this problem flared up. And that was pretty much it. So the issues that I thought about were how to handle her local symptoms, which of course were analgesics and radiotherapy, and then what kind of systemic treatments I was going to suggest.
So Vicente, what kind of systemic therapy were you thinking about? ERPR positive.
An aromatase inhibitor with bisphosphonate therapy would be my initial approach to this patient.
Would you offer any other hormone therapy or just an AI?
Just an aromatase inhibitor.
Rowan?
I'd do the same thing. I think to go tangentially for just a second to remind me to tell people that Quadrinate for bone metastases risk reduction has an approvable letter from the FDA, and they anticipate approval first quarter 2006. I forgot to say that about the bone health issue. And so that means that if that gets approved, everybody is going to be getting oral daily Quadrinate probably beginning in the near future, and many of the bone health questions will go away. Now to switch back to this patient, one of the things that isn't available now that might in the future play a role in this kind of patient is the Abandronate trial, the high-dose Abandronate trial that Julie Grillo is starting. There's a high-dose regimen. You can give Abandronate because it has less nephrotoxicity and high-dose multiple-day schedule. And they have a phase 2 study showing this remarkable, like 70-80% pain improvement in 1 day with this high-dose Abandronate therapy. And so that's a clinical trial comparing that, that you can give that kind of dose and schedule with Zomita because of nephrotoxicity. So it compares traditional Zomita to this high-dose loading schedule for pain control, and it really looks spectacular. It looks like one of those 80%, 90% reduction, most of the people coming off of narcotic analgesics. So that's kind of watch this space for that. But for the management, I agree, aromatase inhibitor and bisphosphonate.
Can you follow up on the case, Dr. Weinstein?
Yes. Well, the first thing I did was give her Zometa, just to add interest to this. And, of course, she became hypocalcemic, so I had to stop that. But then we discussed the various options, and I also thought that hormone therapy was the right way to go, and I offered her the choice of either an aromatase inhibitor or Faslodex. And she felt, for two reasons, that she would prefer Faslodex. Those reasons were that it cost her less money, and because she had the perception, perhaps the misperception, that parenteral therapy was going to be more powerful and better than anything oral. So she was on Faslodex, and so I gave her a 500 milligram loading dose followed by 250 milligrams a month, and amazingly, she started to really get better. Her bone pain diminished, her markers improved, and she got up out of a wheelchair. Now, some of that, of course, may have been attributable to the radiotherapy, but coincident with this was a pretty substantial reduction in the size of the breast primary, which got down to about 50% of what initially presented.
And how far out into treatment is she at this point?
She's about 5 months out, 5-6 months out. And so among the things that I have to be concerned about now is what to do with the breast primary.
And how is she tolerating the Faslodex? Any side effects?
Great. Absolutely great.
It's interesting that neither of you brought up an option that she actually chose. And, you know, I'm not too surprised. That's a common question when you ask people that. People don't bring up the issue of fulvestrant. We actually did a study of 260 women with metastatic breast cancer and posed the situation of choosing between IM injection and a pill once a day, assuming equal efficacy and side effects. And we actually found that about a third of the women prefer the injection. Some of them cited the dynamic that you did, that there's this thing about, you know, parenteral therapy. We didn't even bring up the issue of the reimbursement, which is a practical clinical issue. Some preferred it because of convenience. A lot of them, like this woman, was coming in, at least initially, for bisphosphonate. So I'm just kind of curious, Rowan, in terms of decision-making, why is it that we don't think about Faslodex more?
Maybe the one reason is we have experience with patients with metastatic disease, put them on aromatase inhibitor, put them on Arimidex, and then 30 months later they come up in your office and they kind of forget that they have metastatic disease, and I don't have that experience yet with Faslodex. So I think maybe that's, tempers it. I said, even if patients have a lot of bone pain, I know I have a backlog of people who just kind of show up as being pretty good on just this oral therapy. But I think the arguments are reasonable. One question I want to ask about was the vitamin D level obtained before starting bisphosphonates?
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, we're redoing the bone health guidelines. That's going to come in there now, as the boneheads now tell us that vitamin D levels should be done before starting bisphosphonate therapy because low vitamin D will predispose the patient to hypocalcemia. So it's kind of like we didn't know about that 3 years ago, but now the boneheads are telling us that that's what we should be doing. So I think that's going to be coming forward. Right?
Vicente Leslie Fallowfield, who's done a lot of the quality of life work on the ATTACC trial, did a study similar to ours in patients with breast cancer, asking her the same thing. How would you prefer? Found the same exact thing. About a third of patients preferred the injection. Why aren't we thinking about fulvestrant more often?
It seems that the majority of the patients prefer oral therapy. And so fulvestrant has been tested against tamoxifen and it has been tested against anastrozole, and the efficacy is similar, hormonal therapy. So I had an occasional patient that they also believe in the injection, they get it in, and I also run the county hospital in Houston, and sometimes compliance could be a problem. You get the injection in, I think it's a reasonable approach. I'm not saying that it's inferior. We prefer, as a first-line patient in this situation, to use an aromatase inhibitor, but I think a fulvestrant is an equal option.
One of the issues is dose and schedule, and I think that's an issue. Thinking again about our pharmacy, kind of a P&T committee, which only lets us use the kind of conventional dose and schedule, we all have this question, loading dose, high dose, all the trials or most of the trials going out, either comparing standard therapy or using high dose or loading dose regimens. So you hate to use something first line where you're not sure of the dose and schedule. And that reminded me about the tamoxifen trial, where certainly everybody was puzzled by why it wasn't superior. And that gave another signal that we might be using the wrong dose and schedule. And so then if that was straightened out from some of the phase threes that are ongoing, it would be a lot easier to have a stronger recommendation for use in first-line therapy.
Vicente, we're seeing a lot more docs in practice doing what Dr. Weinstein did here, which is start out with a loading dose, in this case 500 milligrams of fulvestrant. When you do use fulvestrant, how do you approach the dose and schedule?
Our bias is to use the loading dose. And contrary to what you just said, when I use fulvestrant, I use it more like a second or third-line therapy. And we heard earlier that, those 3 months is good enough in a drug that takes some time to get the steady state of 3 to 6 months. And so based on some of the evidence that we have in the clinic, as well as comparing to 125 versus 250, 125 arm was stopped after 30 patients in the initial trial of fulvestrant. Most people, I don't know if you recall, the trial was between 125 of fulvestrant versus 250 of fulvestrant versus anastrozole. But after the first 30 patients in the clinical trial and the international as well as in the U.S. trial, there was no objective responses in the 125 milligrams. So, and there was also some preclinical data and some early clinical data suggesting that maybe it's dose-dependent. And so if I'm going to stick a little longer in hormonal therapy, I use the bias to give them loading dose. And that way, I may have the higher chance to get a hormonal response in a patient. But that's just bias. I'll show you the scheme of the studies that they're alluding to that. But we use the loading dose, 500, 250, and then 250. So we get 1 gram in 28 days, and then we put it 250. As you know, there is another schedule that you use 500, 500, 500 and then 500 a month. That's the European, the Italian, Spanish trial comparing to just the standard dose. So.
Can you address the question of the primary lesion in this situation? I take it it's not a local problem, it's not causing symptoms?
It's asymptomatic, and it's bulky.
How big is it right now?
It's now about 5 by 5, and no palpable axillary nodes.
Rowan?
Yeah, our surgeons would remove a tumor that size, you know, for local control, and I think it's a patient issue. I think that's the way they view it. We have a multidisciplinary tumor board, I'm sure most places do, where you have an active discussion. They don't mind removing them. I think the patient, it's unlikely that you're going to lose local control if you're watching the patient closely, seeing them every month, and they're getting injections. So it isn't that issue so much as the patients oftentimes don't like to keep score, and so to just remove the scoreboard is enough reason, I think, for our surgeons to go in and take it out. And basically, they may even stretch what they're willing to do with the lumpectomy, depending on how big the breast is and if they thought they could get a good cosmetic result. They wouldn't view it as a cancer operation.
Well, remember, she was unaware of an 8-centimeter tumor, so she's really unaware of this thing.
There was a paper from Seema Khan and Monica Morrow. It was a retrospective analysis of a database suggesting maybe a survival advantage of removing a primary in the face of metastatic disease. Do you think that that's in consideration also, Rowan?
Well, I mean, I think those data are always suspect because who comes forward for, you know, there's so much confounding of who would want a primary removed, somebody who gets a perception that they're doing better, who may actually be doing better. The surgeons have to decide that she's doing better than oncologist. So you have three people conspiring that she's going to be better than the woman who doesn't have it. So I wouldn't use that as a reason, but there's a number of women who really don't like a primary in their breast that they can feel.